This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
All right, 14 minutes after 2 o'clock. We have a terrific guest here. Roger has been our guest in the past a couple of times. Always a great storyteller, and here he is. Direct from Mount Olive, Illinois. His home for a number of years.
Born in White City.
1938, so I didn't get very far.
No. Here he is, Roger Cradiville. Thanks for joining us today, Roger.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me here. I got new hearing aids today from Solutions in Litchfield, so I'm ready to be doing some listening as well as a few little talking.
All right. There are about four things we wanted to discuss today. A couple you brought along, a couple I've got to brought along. Sean and I are here, and we were discussing earlier a bit about the Cardinals. I know that you've spent a long time as a scout for the Cardinals. You've been involved in that organization for years and years. Other than the period of time when Mike Jorgensen was the first baseman, have you had a period where we've looked as flat?
Just what?
Have you seen a period of time where the Cardinals have looked as flat as they are?
I don't know. As flat is probably a little difficult to use, but I would say there have been times. It's a roller coaster. When I first started in 79 with the Cardinals, I had the 80s right after that, and that's Whitey years. And there were times when they were down also. But, you know, Whitey had two rules. You don't be in the ballpark on time and give 110%. Your personal life, your social, whatever you did socially was not a big concern of his. But a lot of things have got to go wrong, you know. And, of course, the first reaction of people is fire somebody. You know, get rid of the manager, get rid of the general manager, get rid of the president, whoever. But it's all going to boil down to the DeWitts. And when they decide that it's affecting the box office and it's affecting what they're bringing in, then some changes will probably be made. But if you notice in the last few probably months or maybe even from the beginning, they've taken turns from no hitting to no pitching, good pitching, you know, and they brought in Arenado, which I thought solidified the lineup. It made everybody better in that lineup by having Arenado. And, you know, at the end of the year, he's going to have to make a decision. Do I want to stay here or not? The Cardinal way that has always been advertised is winning way. And when only teams, the only teams you can beat are the bad teams. I got Pittsburgh coming in right now, just left Miami. And Pittsburgh's struggling like mad. A good friend of mine is the manager, Derek Shelton, of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he's struggling to get a lineup that will be good. And when they play the Cardinals, you know, right now they're pretty much even. I mean, I wouldn't say the Cardinals are better than Pittsburgh at this moment. And when you lost Flaherty, you lost your best pitcher. So everything else is secondary, even though Wainwright is doing well. Was he 5-5 now or something like that?
Right.
And he will continue to be steady. But he will not be the superstar that he once was.
But he's 5-5 now. He could have been 9-1 just as easy. He got no run support. He had one bad outing, I think, since the whole season started. So
that's always the problem, you know. I mean, there's been a lot of games where the Cardinals got two hits.
Yeah.
I mean, when you got Goldsmith and you got Arenado back to back, and Kevin, now you're adding the third outfielder down there, and I see they brought the new kid up, and I'm glad to see him because they've got some good ball players in the minor leagues. And keep in mind, there used to be a natural sequence, A ball. You know, it used to be A, B, C, D ball, or D ball, then back to A, then double A, then triple A. Now they bring guys up from A ball. You know, if this guy's a superstar, do you really want to lose? I mean, how much seasoning does he have to have when he's played these years, particularly when they play college ball? How much
Tampa Bay just showed that, bringing up the number one draft pick in the MLB last year. What's he do? He hits a home run his first game up, you know. So.
But that's their... That's a philosophy of an organization. I mean, the scouting department establishes a philosophy on how to do this. And the Cardinals right now don't want to make those kind of moves. In fact, I, from a personal standpoint, it seems like they wait too long with certain people. I mean, they give him every chance in the world. I mean, there's They just do. I mean, I thought this Thomas was going to be good outfielder. And, I mean, he's never produced. You know, he's just never been the person that they were looking for to kick in that offense. And, you know, they don't have a leadoff hitter now. Edmund is going to move him around a little bit. They talked about in the Postal Dispatch this morning about moving Goldsmith to leadoff. You don't want the best, one of the best power hitters as your leadoff. And the philosophy is to let him bat more times. You know what that amounts to? Maybe one more time. Maybe.
And I think, on the other hand, I feel like they rushed Hicks. I think, especially the kid with the flamethrower, and he's you know, just in, I think enthralled striking out big league hitters with that fastball, and I think he never learned restraint. But that's, again, my untrained eye compared to yours.
Well, you know, just watch the College World Series a little bit. Watch how many innings these guys pitch. I mean, how many pitches they throw. And so on. And, you know, that's always, there was always a sort of a debate between college and professional. You know, sign the contract, be a professional, stay in college. You know, like when my son Tim, when he did, he stayed in college before he played pro ball. So now he's the principal over at Pawnee High School and Junior High. Okay, that was a result of him sticking with it. But now, if they'd have dangled $500,000 in front of him or something like that as a junior, hey, that could be a different thing, you know. So if you look at the colleges and high schools, when we ran the Cardinal Open Camps in Busch Stadium, we would bring in, well, we had a draft camp first. That was in June, then now it's going to be in July, which is for the colleges. They want to let the colleges finish their World Series and all that stuff. But when we ran the camps in there, we used to allow college coaches and to come there. Yeah, I mean, Itchy Jones from SIU Carbondale, Illinois, would be there. And a guy from Missouri, Gene McArthur, who was a good friend of mine. These guys would come there and watch it. So we were doing all the work, but training them and showing them this and that. And then they would make them an offer for college. And if they were, I wouldn't say borderline, but they wouldn't get the big money. Let's put it that way. They would take them. And so, you know what we did? So about the last 6-7 years, we barred them. We wouldn't let any college coaches there. I don't know the reason for it other than what I just told you, because when we sat in on those drafts, and I sat in the drafts from 1979 to 2002, sat in on drafts with Ted Simmons and, you know, Fred McAllister and a lot of the high Cardinal people, but they always looked at the tools, you know, 2-2s, 3-2, 5-tools, you know, and so on. And an evaluation is something that it's a timely thing. It's almost like you time them now and you find out if they're going to be good enough to play 162 games a year.
One of the other interesting things that we've talked about in the past, moving on from the Cardinals, because we have beat that horse practically. Into,
that conversation would never end.
Yeah, I know. It would never end. You're right. Let's talk a little bit now about something closer to home. Roger, one of the biggest struggles right now is for high school and elementary, junior high, and I'm sure college too, getting officials, whether it's umpires, football referees, basketball referees. It is so difficult to convince people, maybe after they stop playing, to become an official. And the need for it right now is great.
Well, I'll tell you what's happened with that. And I won't say they don't need the money, because the money is really good now for umpires and referees in football and basketball and so on. I was a referee. I had a license from 1960 till forever, you know. And I refereed some junior grade school basketball. And it wasn't any fun. I mean, you'd get letters from people. I remember one, this is kind of funny. I won't mention his name, although I did tell him he's deceased now. But I refereed a game between Bunnell and Manali. Now, I'm from Manali, okay. But that wasn't unusual. When you used to go to Staunton, you'd see, you know, Fred Brenzel, the coach referee. You go to Glisby, a guy named Beef Sexton would be referee. He's Glisby. And so on. And so every town did that because, you know, I got like $3. the referee gave in 1960. You don't know, put it against what they pay him now. But anyway, I got this. I always remember it because it was written on yellow onion skin. Think about that. It was tight, actually. No, it was written, handwritten. And he told me, he said, I just want to apologize. I'm writing a letter to you to apologize for my conduct in the basketball game the other day. But, you know, you for Mount Olive, and we thought the calls were slanted. And I was a strong believer that you call the game honestly, no matter who it affected, because, you know, I got problems with my superintendent at my school. He's my boss one time over a call I made when his kid was playing. And what a position to be put in.
Holy cow.
So anyway, this guy writes this letter to me, and he was, by the way, a judge in Macoupin County at one time. That won't narrow down too much. But anyway, he wrote this letter. He said, the only reason I'm writing this letter to you is because my wife told me that if I don't write this letter, she'll never speak to me again because she had embarrassed me in front of the family. And I wrote him a letter back. I typed him a letter back and told him just what I said about other towns. That, you know, we're honest. You know, we're there for the kids. You know, I mean, you can't get officials now because the money is not as necessary to them anymore. And two, the interest of young people in sports is limited now. Look at the schools. You look at big schools like Litchfield or Staunton or Gillespie and Hillsboro, these areas around here. Okay, so they get 20 guys out for baseball. They should get 45, 50. Look at Mount Olive. I mean, we had 6 kids out for baseball in March, and we were able to, that's a long story, but I won't get into that, talk to the kids and get head up to 17. And they went to the finals of the regional and got beat by defending good team Oakallville. So, and probably the best right-handed pitcher in the whole area was Carter Monk, the kid from Mount Olive, whose brother pitches for Arkansas, who was the number one team in the country. Big left-hander, 6'5", wild, you know, just what they want.
Just what they want, yeah. We'll take a little short break. We'll be right back with more with Roger and Sean as we discuss things. We'll be right back. We are back with Roger Cradaville, Sean and I, along with him, and visiting about, of course, we talked about the Cardinals, we've talked about the referee situation. Sean, I want to get into the celebration and the article that you wrote about the police. We want to talk about that. But did you have something else you wanted to ask before?
I just thought, what a neat time to join the organization, because I know the 70s, well, St. Louis, I mean, it's hard for people younger to realize, was a football town. The cardiac Cardinals, and you know, they're watching Steve Carlton do great in Philadelphia, Jerry Royce doing great other places, L.A., what have you. And I still remember as a kid, you know, Kenny Boyer's in there, and he didn't have much to work with. And he had names like Mike Tyson, and I don't mean the boxer.
Yeah.
Tony Scott, and just a very uninspiring lineup. It was great to see Lou Brock's little exit, you know, his final year, but that had to be something when the White Rat came to town. I mean, these deadline deals in July, they're all well and good, but I can't imagine how exciting it was to be a part of those winter meetings. Like, oh, Raleigh Fingers came to town. All right. Oh, Raleigh Fingers is good. he wasn't even here long enough to have a uniform. He never actually came to town. Those winter meetings, when he revamped the roster, that must have been something.
Well, he shipped some people out of town that most fans didn't want shipped out of town. You think about getting rid of the catcher and the first baseman and Vukovich, you know, and some of those. But I can only attest this for the 10 years that I knew him or knew was there when he was there. What you see is what you get. That's the way he is. In fact, a couple years, when I always was dressed in Cardinal uniform when I worked with the Cardinals, because that's what they wanted. The scouts who were hands-on, and I was hands-on. Some of the scouts were too old. George Silva, who's at Harry Walker, you might remember the Hall of Fame hitter, they were kind of old to be even put on a uniform, so they just used their brains and their lips to tell us what to do, and we jumped, too, when they told us what to do. But I used to dress in places where they didn't have a special place for me. I dressed in a clubhouse. I dressed in Whitey's office twice. I thought it was amazing they allowed me to do that. I mean, they don't know me from, you know, I mean, there's stuff on his desk. You know, that's where I dress. I got pictures at home of me coming out of his office. Like, it's impressive to me. You know, I mean, maybe nobody else, but it's impressive to me.
But nobody called you Mr. Herzog.
No, no. But what you see is what you got. He was that way. He liked beer. He drank beer. And he was not afraid to stop at after a game someplace and chat. I told this story maybe once on the sports line on Saturday, but I'll make this real quick. Hal Simpson Jr. was a sub teacher of mine. His dad had a shoe store in Litchfield. And he said, have you ever meet Whitey Herzog? And I said, yeah, I see him often. And when I go into games, I'll be in the dugout for a while. And he said, would you ask him if he remembers my dad, who was his Boy Scout leader? And so the next game I was at, he was sitting in the dugout just before the game, hour before the game. And Yogi Berra was with him, at that time was a coach for Houston. Okay, they're sitting together, and I said, excuse me, Whitey. I said, I got a question. And a guy asked me, and I told him the whole story. And that was Hal Simpson's father, your Boy Scout leader in New England. And he said, yeah. And Yogi starts laughing. And I don't understand him laughing. So I said, Yogi, what's funny about that? He said, I can't picture Whitey as a Boy Scout. I've never forgotten that story because that, I mean, it had nothing to do with Whitey after. It was now Yogi Berra taking over and having something to say. I can't picture him as a Boy Scout.
I guess so.
I just, you know, and that's the one thing I sit there and I think of La Russa, Matheny, and Schilt doing these post-game shows, and I mean, it's like Dramamine.
Yeah.
But I just imagine, back then you didn't have post-game shows hardly
right.
on television. Game's over, broadcast over. Yeah. This is Jennings Randolph, Mike, Ron Jacober, and yeah. it's over.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how entertaining Whitey Herzog post-game shows would have been.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing about it is a lot of people don't remember after the image that we have of Whitey. But when he left there because there were problems within the team. Mm-hmm. Now, I know some names, but I really can't report them because he just had some people that, you know, like Richie, what was the guy named that he had?
Dick Allen?
Yeah, Dick. Well, yeah, he wanted to know that his name was Richie Young.
Right.
And he said, call me Dick. You know,
right.
Because he was a pretty tough guy. So there were certain ones who had an enemy. Well, he had a couple on those good teams that he had to be able to motivate around. You know, these are all individual personalities, and they have their quirks, and just like all of us three here. And some things are good for the team, and some aren't good for the team. And you can't ship them out all the time. Sometimes you got to be able to get something out of them.
Well, true.
One of the things that we wanted to talk about today, Roger, kind of goes back to an article that you wrote in your column for the Buzz and for the Mount Olive Herald recently, talking about the blue line.
Yeah. I've been wanting to write that story for years. I've written 75 stories from my very first one that was called For the Love of Trains. I love trains. I've always loved trains as a kid. Got in trouble more than once at school when I should have been listening to the teacher and I was watching them bring the coal cars into Mine 15 in White City. But I survived all of that. I've always wanted to write a story on the police. And as you well know, in today's times particularly, it's pretty controversial. I mean, what road, what path do you take to write it? Well, I'm a strong believer in police. Now, I know we make this political. One party loves police, one party doesn't like. That's baloney. It's up to the individual, the individual, how they feel about police. We all know somebody who was not a good cop. Okay, do you remember somebody who wasn't a good teacher? Do you remember somebody who wasn't a good plumber? And so on and so on. Yes, we all can remember people that were not good. Now, do we take away their funding because of one bad? No. Too bad? No. What we do is, no matter what the number is, we weed them out and we move on. And that's what's part of my story. I told about experiences I've had with police. And I'm kind of like a deputy sheriff in Macoupin County. Because I have these jobs, you know, they're called lifetime jobs. You know, you can't get out of them. I've been on the Sheriff Scholarship Committee since 1986. Started with old Bill Parmentier, some of you can remember him, or Amo Borgini, the Gillespie superintendent. We started together. Well, Amo's passed away, and Bill's gotten older. He's in the middle 80s, and a good friend of mine and so on. So I'm still there. So every year the sheriff calls me. Well, they gave me a deputy sheriff's badge. And I don't do anything with it. I mean, I'm not going to arrest you guys for anything here. But I have this badge and as a sheriff scholarship committee. Well, the point I'm getting at is I support the police because the police need support. And if you read my story, I talked about the Old West. You know, the Old West that we read in Zane Grey and all these stories is not necessarily the way the Old West was. Many of your top, I mean, if you had to defend your house, you could say, yep, I've got a gun in my house, and somebody walks in that door I don't know, I'm going to plug them. And if my family is threatened, and you might do that. But the chances are it's not as easy to just shoot somebody. You might think the people on the street do that all the time, and it's easy. It's not easy to go ahead. I had a friend of mine who named Jack Tuggle, who was in World War II, and he was trained to kill as a Marine. All right. He told me, he said, I always felt that I would give this guy a fair shake because I just can't shoot somebody. He said, but you know, when that Japanese stuck his head out of that foxhole, I shot him with every bullet in my gun. He said, I just did what I was trained to do. And later he was one of those people after World War II, if you remember, that said, join the reserves. There'd never be another war, and you get so much bucks a month for beer money. Remember that? And so guess what? 1950, President Truman decides it's a national emergency. He goes to Korea and gets his leg shot off. So he was not wounded in World War II as a Marine, but he gets his leg shot off in Korea. The point I'm making is that, you know, to do those things, it takes a little bit more. I have guns. I mean, I've had them. Most people I know have guns. I mean, we're not like maybe some of those states that carry them, like Missouri. I think you can carry them, right? In Missouri, I don't know. I'd probably shoot myself before I'd shoot somebody else by accident. You know, the old Barney Fife attitude, you know. But you see, this in the Old West, many of those gunfights that we read about and love on TV were not gunfights. I mean, the guy was shot in the back. The guy was shot from behind a rock. The guy was shot from behind a building. Hey, fair? Hey, we walk on Main Street like Matt Dillon and Gunsmoke, and we draw and we out to him. Sure, there were those things. Did happen. But the thing about it is, it's not really realism. And when it comes to your house, protecting your house or your property, that's realism. Now it's, what are you going to do with that gun? Are you going to use it or are you not going to use it? And none of us know. Until that time comes, none of us.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. So when we see, and we see it even in our rural area, non-urban area, we have people who are strung out on meth. We have drug dealers. We see the state police stop cars and trucks on the interstate on the way for a routine traffic violation, and they find the dogs find the drugs. Danger is everywhere, you know.
I put a story in there about the Newark, New Jersey police. You remember reading about that? They changed their whole attitude. They were tired. They were one of the deadliest cities in the United States for people being killed. And so they changed the rules. First of all, they did hire more Hispanics and African-American policemen. They ended these stops. At night, just stopping a car on suspicion unless there was a all-points bulletin or something out on that car for something that occurred. And they had training, training for all the police up there. In 2 years past, this, by the way, was in the Week magazine like Time. Its story was in there, and I use it as part of my story. They did not shoot their gun. The police in Newark did not fire their gun one time. and they had zero lawsuits against the police for whatever. That's how it changed. See, don't stop in the cars. It, you know, profiling. You know, I can see that. You can see that. There's a whole car full of guys that look like they're not going to be to no good. You stop it, and maybe you might stop the crime. But you have a fine line there. What you draw is when you go overboard or not. Now, you've seen some cases, no matter what side that you're on, Bob, believe me, you're on both sides when it comes to how police handle cases. But I know some of these people that they have to deal with. I had to deal with some of them, or their parents in school as a principal, and I wasn't a policeman. And that was fun. I worked as a chaser for a small loan company when I was in college. I played ball for this company, this team in Springfield, and the owner gave me a job. And that was what they call a chaser. That means when you have a loan and you don't pay it, they send people out to get you. I saw my partner get hit in the mouth, lose his job. I had to go search one guy at his at an apartment in Springfield who was wanted to police that wanted by the police that I did not know he was wanted. Glad to please. Now, I lucked out on all those instances, but I saw what we were dealing with, the type of people we were dealing with. There are all kinds out there. Because you're poor doesn't make you dangerous, you know, but it does contribute to your need for money, and if your morals are such that you're going to, you know, it's mine, you're going to take it. I won't get into details on it, but Chris Rock's got a great routine about people stealing from him. And I won't, like I said, no use getting into it because there's a lot of language involved there. And but it's a great routine. If you ever get here about how his mom taught him about people stealing from him, it's a funny, funny line.
All right. Roger, when you do your columns, you do so much history about so many people in Macoupin County, the bowling stories you've talked about and all the different things. Do you have people who maybe say, Roger, do you remember you ought to write about this?
Oh,
do you
get that? That happens all the time. People will see me and say, you know, this would be a good topic to write about. But I can't do that. Like I said, I'm not an author. I'm just a writer. I write like I talk. If you read my column, it's like you're talking to me. And Bob Fulton, principal, former principal of Gillespie High School, always mentions that to me. Every time I always send him a story, and his health's not been the best now, and it's kind of perked him up with my story. And I've sent him probably 70 of them, every story I write. By the way, those stories go all over. They go to Ball, Georgia. They go to Holyoke, Allison, Massachusetts. They go to Sherwood, Illinois. They go to Cisco Tech. They go all over the place. And these people pass them around because they're human interest stories. And if you've heard me now, I'm a strong believer in humor. I really am. If you could put humor, you could break people down. You know, now there's a fine line between humor and being a smart aleck. You know what I mean? Or there's another word for that, too, but I can't use it on the air. But there's a fine line between it. But they're both funny. That's the point I'm getting at. You just got to draw the line as to which one you're going to use. You know, but when I write these stories, I think about them by myself. And in other words, I've got two stories in mind now that I haven't written yet. I don't even know what I'm going to do with them. One's called The Power of Words. Think about the power of words. Your dad saying love to you. That don't happen often. My dad never did do it, I'm sorry to say. But I missed that, you know, because the old-timers didn't do that much. Those old coal miners, they didn't mention it. It was up to the mother to do that. And my mother mentioned it every day, you know what I mean? So and that, and how about the word pout? When you were with your girlfriend in younger days and you didn't like something she said or did and you got quiet all of a sudden, what are you doing, pouting? Oh, yeah, that's when violence came across your mind, you know. And you can pick certain words. We've had words describing politics lately, you know, with President Trump and President Biden and et cetera and so on and so on. They'll have words. And you, this narcissistic, you know. I'm not that we didn't know that word, but nobody ever used it. Did you call Franklin Roosevelt that? Did you call, you know what I mean, Lincoln that? I mean, all of a sudden, this pops up. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I don't know. Maybe it is that way. I have no idea. But what I'm saying is that these words come up. So I want to do a word on that. And another word, story I'm considering right now is about one's roots. I mean, you think about your roots going back. I mean, you know, some families, they have roots, but they don't care. You know what I mean? It's not a big deal. Me being a historian, you know, I'm thinking about that because that's part of history. You know, what you did when you were young, and like in my story, I said the one I just wrote now. You just got about being poor, and why blame the poor for everything? We don't blame the rich for getting tax free. Why do we blame the poor for everything? You know what I mean?
That's right.
And they're not working now, so obviously it's the poor's problem. But they don't. It's the story is just about. Let's be fair about this. Let's look at both sides and say, I don't care what side you're on. It doesn't make a bit of difference to me. I'm not trying to convince you to believe something. I'm just trying to tell you there's two sides to everything.
I still love that Teddy Roosevelt. Doris Kearns Goodwin said he wanted to be the baby in the hospital, the bride at the wedding, and the corpse at the funeral.
That's a great story. Teddy's one of my favorites. Yeah, if you read about Teddy, they were always trying to hide him.
Wow.
You know, they hit him in New York, and they made him police chief. And he cleaned up the cops. All of a sudden, the cops got to be on their beat. They've got to take no more free apples off the stand. He made them do all that stuff. So, gosh, we can't keep him in there because the party bosses found out that Teddy Roosevelt was messing up their power. So they moved him up. They moved him to another job. Next thing you know, they made him vice president. Whoever remembers a vice president? So they made him vice president to McKinley. And then McKinley standing there shaking hands with a guy named Sogels, which was a foreign person, and he shoots him. And now guess what happened? That guy they were hiding is now the president. So all his life they were trying to hide him.
Yeah.
Can't hold back the bull moose.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, that's how he got more votes than the Republicans in that election. 1912.
Wilson, oh, my gosh.
Wilson won, and Roosevelt, the Republicans wouldn't pick Roosevelt.
Well, what a visionary it had.
Oh, gosh. Yep.
Well, I'll tell you, it's, these are great conversations. I'll tell you, this is one thing I worry about is the art of storytelling. You know, newspapers, and I know newspapers have their struggles these days. I know it's something you can't completely teach it, but is that one of your concerns when we look at radio, newspapers, and 10 years down the road that we're not going to have a storyteller or anyone with institutional knowledge?
Well, we could look at it that way, but I do this to my wife all the time, and she'll say something about, you know, whoa, is the country, or this is happening. I said, do you remember ever heard of 1920 and what the people did about their bad habits? They're bobbing their hair, and the girls are smoking, and all this stuff. And, oh, I mean, heaven help us, we're dying as a country. And you had all these evangelists pop up all of a sudden overnight, and they were preaching, you're going to hell many different ways. And then all of a sudden, the Depression hit, 1929. Everything changed. Everybody became desperate. They became closer. They went to church now, which they don't do now. And so something will come up. I'm a strong believer in cycles. In history, if you look at history, you have recessions, you have depressions, you have prosperity. And all that dictates personal habits. Now, there are a lot of people who strongly believe in church now, and there's a lot of people who don't believe it has a role in their life. And this can be families that had church all their life. Hey, I go to church most Sundays. I never believed that. I was growing up in White City. I never knew anybody went to church. I mean, when I was 15, 16, and whenever, there's an old joke that whenever I dated a girl that was, you know, some religion, I became that overnight. You know, she was, yeah, she was a Baptist, I was a Baptist. She was a Buddha, I was a Buddha. You know, that's an old joke, but that's really true. So that meant something. It meant to me that there was something missing in my life. If I would go, I wasn't there just to get their attention because, as most guys when they're younger, the girls come and go and the boys come and go. You know what I mean? They're just passing through. And so if you were a Lutheran for a while or a Catholic or something, it was just temporary. It was just to be part of something. And I remembered Easter, and I used to have to fill out a form. when you come there, that you know, name everything. What religion are you affiliated? It just bothered me. I put zero, nothing.
Hits left, throws right.
Yeah,
praise Lutheran, worships Catholic. Or the scouting report.
But that's the way society is today, and you have to roll with the punches. People like me, who are older, is probably not going to see the reversal. I mean, I don't know how long I'm going to live, but it's kind of funny. I helped my son buy a farm, and I had a 30-year note. I'd have been 125 when I paid off that farm. Well, in the meantime, he bought it from me, and that's why we did it, you know. But all I had was a note for $1 zillion, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, God, they're really trusting me to make these payments for 30 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Get a reverse mortgage on that.
I know there's days I wake up and I don't even buy day-old bananas. I know how that goes. But that's all right. That's okay.
Oh, I love bananas. I just found out don't let them get too ripe because they're full of sugar.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The older they get, the more sugar. So I'm going to quit eating bananas because I want to keep my sugar down.
Oh, my gosh. Roger, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. Anything else you wanted to touch base while I got you here?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I think, basically, when I write these stories, I write stories of interest. If you look at those 70 stories that I have written, you'll see a little bit of everything. I mean, I just wrote one about Born to be a Farmer. I interviewed four families of my students, and talked about how the farms got started. Mom, see, when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time at the Frank Toon farm next door. I live on the edge of White City, and I loved it out there. And my mom once asked me, she said, "What do you want to be when you get older, Roger?" And I said, "I'm not a farmer. I'd love to be a farmer." And then as I got a little older, I found out that to be a farmer, you got to be born a farmer. You can't just go out and buy a farm. Just can't do that. So I find out that, you know, life changes. Things change, you know. I got grandkids right now. One wants to be a nurse, and the girl's young. And the boy's a straight-A student. He's an honor. He plays football, basketball, baseball, bass team, band, you name it all. He wants to be an electrician. And, you know, you think years later, why don't you just go to college and become whatever? No, today, you know, $43 an hour for an electrician. Think about that. That's as much as he's going to make, you know, in most days. We thought, what about going to education? Your dad's a teacher principal. I'm teacher principal, baby. And it takes a certain type to be a teacher. And I don't really know what that is. I mean, you know, if you told me to write it down, I've given speeches on this about what a good teacher is. It varies. There's a lot of things you can put into a good teacher. You probably have teachers right now that you remember. And the more honest evaluation of your teachers, both of you have, is now. Not when you were 16.
Oh, sure.
You'll like the easiest one then. But now you'll want to know who I learned from and what got me, you know, got me to where I'm at today. And same way with me. I have this question on one of my computer things that, who was your favorite teacher at Mount Olive High School? It was Green, Mr. Green. It was a great story. He pushed me. He was an umpire in baseball. He was captured in World War II. Him and his brother both spent time in a concentration camp of the Germans. And when he came home, they tell me that when he got off the bus on Mount Olive Main Street, between the time he got off that bus till he got on 3rd or 4th South, where his parents lived, his mother lived, he took off his whole uniform except his skivvies. He wanted to get rid of that whole effort. He was a bombardier or something, you know. And so, you know, that was my favorite teacher. Now, was he the only one? No, there was a lot of them, you know. And you know yourself, when you had a coach years ago, it had nothing to do with liking a coach. You got to respect a coach. That's the key. Respect them. You know, that's the thing you got to look at.
One of the things, you know, I had a history teacher in high school who also was in a prisoner of war camp from the Germans, and the Russians liberated his camp. And he never had a bad thing to say about the Russians, you know, ever. Right. And this was during the Cold War when I was in high school. So it was interesting. But one of the things that he always talked about was how the German prisoners were treated at the American POW camps versus how he was treated.
Right.
Now, he said if we caught a rat, there was meat in our potato soup.
Yeah,
you
right.
know. And he said the German prisoners sometimes complained about their steak being too tough. And the non-commissioned officers who were the guards who had been mistreated in the German POW camp had to have a great deal of restraint when they complained because they were beaten. And
well, you know, a lot of the German prisoners spent their prison time in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and we brought thousands of German prisoners over here. We didn't put them in camps over there. We didn't have many camps over there. We brought them here, and many of them married locals and lived happily ever after, never went back to Germany.
You bet. Our guest has been Roger Cradaville, Mount Olive historian, Macoupin County historian. One day, soon, before summer is over, you're going to come back and we're going to talk about trains. Because I think that would be a fun conversation as well.
Son of a railroader, I'd love to hear it.
And again, of course, we also want to talk about, that would include talking about the interurban. That would also include talking about the Chautauqua. So you might have to do a little research.
Yeah, we talked about Chautauqua last year.
Yes, we did. It's still one of my favorite subjects, and I wasn't old enough to catch it.
Well, for all those people out there who thought history was boring, believe me, it's not boring. And you think it doesn't change because it's history? Yes, it does. Because I can name you times. I didn't know there were black soldiers that were at the Custer's Last Stand. Wasn't taught in the 60s. All right? The Buffalo Soldiers, you know? You know why the Buffalo Soldiers went out west? These are African-American. Because when they were, after the Civil War, the South, they couldn't go north because there was prejudice. They couldn't stay in the South because there was prejudice. So they went west where if they could shoot a gun, ride a horse, they were equal. Shoot a gun, ride a horse, they were equal to anybody out there.
Yeah.
In other words, did you pull your own? That's all.
You bet. Anything else you want to add before we wrap this up?
Gosh, it's so fascinating, but boy, it's amazing. Yeah, I think it's, you talked about those teachers, World War II and the Greatest Generation. That's the thing that hits me. I mean, you start talking about them, you picture the sands of Normandy, you picture Pearl, you picture Midway. But that's the underappreciated part of the story. The impact they brought back, the communities they made better, they made these great parks. In the 50s, they were the mayors, they were, they built the lakes. I mean, their legacy goes far beyond what they did in the European and Pacific theaters.
Well, they've been to hell and back. And now that they came back here, they were ready to stay away from hell. So they would now do the things that were necessary to develop communities and farms and factories and et cetera.
Yeah, you're right. Roger, it's been great having you.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thanks, John, for hanging around. And we will do this again in a few months. As for now, we will wrap this little visit up, and we'll do it again sometime.